The Dubey Train by Ken Temba. Ken Temba was born in 1924 in what is now Limpopo Province. He worked in Johannesburg as a teacher and a journalist and was part of a group of writers and musicians who lived in what was then known as Sophiatown, a vibrant, mixed-race suburb that the apartheid government destroyed with forced removals. He then moved to Swaziland, where he died in 1968. The Dubey Train. The morning was too cold for a summer morning, at least to me, a child of the sun. But then on all Monday mornings, I feel rotten and shivering with a clogged feeling in the chest and a nauseous churning in the stomach. It debilitates my interest in the whole world around me. The Dubey station, with the prospect of congested trains filled with sour-smelling humanity, did not improve my impression of a hostile life directing its malevolence plumb at me. Despairing thoughts of every kind darted through my mind. The lateness of the trains, the shoving savagery of the crowd, the grey aspect around me. Even the announcer over the loudspeaker gave confusing directions. I suppose it had something to do with the peculiar chemistry of the body on Monday morning. But for me, all was wrong with the world. Yet, by one of those flukes that occur in all routines, the train I caught was not full when it came. I usually try to avoid seats next to the door, but sometimes it cannot be helped. So it was on that Monday morning when I hopped into the third-class carriage. As the train moved off, I leaned out of the paneless window and looked onto the leaden lackluster platform churning away beneath me like a fast conveyor belt. 2 or 3 yards away, a door had been broken and repaired with masonite so that it could no longer be opened. Moreover, near the door, a seat was missing which transformed the area into a kind of hall. I was sitting opposite a hulk of a man. His hugeness was obtrusive to the sight when you saw him, and to the mind when you looked away. His head tilted to one side in a half-drowsy position with flaring nostrils and trembling lips. He looked like a kind of genie, pretending to sleep but watching your every nefarious intention. His chin was stubbed with crisp little black barbs. The neck was thick and corded, and the enormous chest was a live barrel that heaved back and forth. The overall he wore was open almost down to the navel, and he seemed to have nothing else on underneath. I stared, fascinated at his large breasts with their winking, dark nipples. With the rocking of the train as it rolled towards Pefeni Station, he swayed slightly this way and that, and now and then he lazily chanted a township ditty. The titillating bawdiness of the words incited no honour of lechery or significance. The words were words. The tune was just a tune. Above and around him, the other passengers, looking Monday-bleared, had no enthusiasm about them. They were just like the lights of the carriage, dull, dreary, undramatic. Almost as if they too felt that they should not be alight during the day. Pefeni Station rushed at us, with human faces blurring past. When the train stopped, in stepped a girl. She must have been a mere child. Not just petite, but juvenile in structure. Yet her manner was all adult, as if she knew all about the sorry scheme of things entire, and with a scornful toss relegated it. She had the precocious features of the township girls, pert, arrogant, live. There was that air about her that petrified any grown-ups who might think of asking her for a seat. She sat next to me. The train slid into Pumulong. Against the red brick waiting room, I saw Etsotsi lounging. For all the world, not a damn interested in taking the train, but I knew the type. So I watched him in grim anticipation. When the train started sailing out of the platform, he turned round nonchalantly and tripped along backwards towards an open door. It amazes me no end how these boys know exactly where the edge of the platform comes when they run like that, backwards. Just at the drop, he caught the ledge of the train and heaved himself in gracefully. He swaggered towards us and stood between our seats with his back to the outside, his arms gripping the frame of the paneless window. He noticed the girl and started teasing her. All township lovemaking is rough.
"Hi, Rubberneck!"
He clutched at her pear-like breast jutting from her sweater.
"How long did you think you'd duck me?"
She looked around in panic at me, at the old lady opposite her, at the hulk of a man opposite me. Then she whimpered.
Awubuti, I don't even know you.
The Tsotsi snarled.
You don't know me, eh? You don't know me when you're sitting with your student friends. You don't know last night too, ne? You don't know how you ducked me.
Some woman, reasonably out of reach, murmured,
"The children of today,"
in a drifting sort of way. Mzimhlophe, the dirty white station. The Tsotsi turned round and looked out of the window onto the platform. He recognized some of his friends there and hailed them.
"Oh, Zigzagza, it's how there?
It's Jewish.
Hey, Latolo, my ma hears me. I want that 10 and 6.
Go get it in hell.
Way, my sister, don't listen to that guy. Tell him Shakespeare never said so."
The gibberish exchange was all in exuberant superlatives. The train left the platform in the echoes of its stridency. A washerwoman had just got shoved into it by ungallant males, bundle and all. People in the train made sympathetic noises, but too many passengers had seen too many tragedies to be rattled by this incident. They just remained bleared. As the train approached New Canada, the confluence of the Orlando and the Dubé train lines, I looked over the head of the girl next to me. It must have been a crazy engineer who had designed this crossing. The Orlando train comes from the right. It crosses the Dubé train overhead just before we reach New Canada. But when it reaches the station, it is on the right again, for the Johannesburg train enters extreme left. It is a curious kind of game. Moreover, it has necessitated cutting the hill and building a bridge. But just this quirk of an engineer's imagination has left a spectacularly beautiful scene. After the drab, chocolate box houses of the township, monotonously identical row upon row, this gash of man's imposition upon nature never fails to intrigue me. Our caveman lover was still at the girl while people were changing from our train to the Westgate train in New Canada. The girl wanted to get off, but the Tsotsi would not let her. When the train left the station, he gave her a vicious slap across the face so that her beret went flying. She flung a leg over me and rolled across my lap in her hurtling escape. The Tsotsi followed, and as he passed me, he reeled with the sway of the train. To steady himself, he put a full paw in my face. It smelled sweaty sour. Then he ploughed through the humanity of the train after the girl. Men gave way shamelessly, but one woman would not take it. She burst into a spitfire tirade that whiplashed at the men.
"Lord, you call yourselves men, you poltroons!
You let a small ruffian insult you!
Fancy he grabs at a girl in front of you, might be your daughter, this thing with the manner of a pig! If there were real men here, they'd pull his pants off and give him such a leathering, he'd never sit down for a week! But no, you let him do this here. Tonight, you let him do it in your homes, and all you do is whimper! The children of today have never no respect, sis!"
The men winced. They said nothing, merely looked around at each other in shy embarrassment. But those barbed words had brought the little thug to a stop. He turned around, scowled at the woman, and with cold calculation, cursed her anatomically, twisting his lips to give the word the full measure of its horror. It was like the son of Ham finding a word for his awful discovery. It was like an impression that shuddered the throne of God Almighty. It was both defilement and a defiance.
Hela, you street urchin. That woman is your mother,
came the shrill voice of the big hulk of a man, who had all the time been sitting quietly opposite me, humming his lewd little township ditty. Now he moved towards where the Tsotsi stood rooted. There was menace in every swing of his clumsy movement, and the half-mumbled tune of his song sounded like under-breath cursing for all its calmness. The carriage froze into silence. Suddenly, the woman shrieked and men scampered onto seats. The Tsotsi had drawn a sheath knife, and he faced the big man. There is something odd that a knife does to various people in a crowd. Most women go into pointless clamor, sometimes even hugging fast the men who might fight for them. Some men make gangway, stampeding helter-skelter, but with that hulk of a man, the sight of the gleaming blade in the Tsotsi's hand drove him berserk. The splashing people left a sort of arena. There was an evil leer in his eye, much as if he were experiencing satanic satisfaction. Crucis Cemetery flashed past. Seconds before the impact, the Tsotsi lifted the blade and plunged it obliquely. Like an instinctive predatory beast, he seemed to know exactly where the vulnerable jugular was, and he aimed for it. The jerk of the train deflected his stroke, though, and the blade slit a long cleavage down the big man's open chest. With a demoniacal scream, the big man reached out for the boy crudely, careless now of the blade that made another gash in his arm. He caught the boy by the upper arm with the left hand and between the legs with the right and lifted him bodily. Then he hurled him towards me. The flight went clean through the painless window, and only a long cry trailed in the wake of the rushing train. Suddenly, passengers darted to the windows. The human missile was nowhere to be seen. It was not a fight proper, not a full-blown quarrel. It was just an incident in the morning, Dube train. The big man, bespattered with blood, got off at Langlachte station. Only after we had left the station did the stunned passengers break out into a cacophony of chattering. Odd that no one expressed sympathy for the boy or the man. They were just greedily relishing the thrilling episode of the morning.